This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It was hard to miss those pictures, that video, of an Airbus A320, a big commercial airliner, splashing down into the Hudson River. A few moments later, passengers on the U.S. Airways flight emerged onto the wings of the plane and waited for rescue. In just a few seconds after both engines lost power, the pilot of that plane, Chesley Sully Sullenberger, assessed his options and decided he would not be able to get back to the airport. With amazing calm, he identified the river as the safest place to come down and brought it in perfectly. Everyone on board survived. Sully Sullenberger credits his crew, first of all, but also the long years of training and education that gave him the experience to make just the right call at just the right moment. He's also talked about how his profession has changed over the years and why there might not be so many like him in the future. So, pilots, call and tell us how your job has changed, what your work life is like, and tell us what makes a good pilot. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, the certainty of financial advice in very uncertain times. But first, what makes a good pilot? We begin with Matt Wald, aviation safety reporter for the New York Times, with us from our bureau in New York. Matt, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Neil.
Would every commercial pilot flying today know how to do what Captain Sullenberger did?
Well, every airline pilot trains for it, although the quality of the training is uncertain. I spoke to one pilot who said that he had asked last time he was in the simulator to simulate that landing, but you're just coming down in a big field of blue, and nobody's really sure how accurate the simulator is because there's no good engineering data for that kind of thing.
Well, they may have some now that the flight data recorders have been recovered.
Yes, exactly. I think in this case, it's possible to say that he made a decision that worked out well, and it's possible to say we shouldn't second-guess somebody who made a snap judgment in a real crisis situation. Later on, some engineer's going to go back and figure out whether he did have enough altitude and momentum to make it back to the runway, or whether this was his only option.
Or whether if he'd toggled this switch this way, the engines would have come on and everything would have been fine.
Well, you know, it's interesting. What he did was he turned the first officer loose on the restart checklist, which is this, it's laminated, you flip through it, it's like loose leaf, and it shows you step by step how to restart the engines, but it's designed for use at 35,000 feet, and he was at 3,200 feet. There was no way they were going to get through it, even if the engines were restartable. So he was flying by the book, but that wasn't working.
And listening to the tapes of Sullenberger talking with air traffic control, you can't help but think how amazingly calm he is that this unprecedented situation, obviously, that somehow he was ready for.
Alas, it's not unprecedented. It's just unprecedented they survived. He was fully loaded. Usually you have one pilot flying and then the pilot not flying talks on the radio. He had told the pilot not flying, in this case the first officer, to go ahead and run the restart checklist, and therefore he was doing two jobs at once, and he was doing them with great proficiency. That's true.
I'm sure you've spoken with many pilots. I'll ask you. They must react to this story with incredible professional pride, but what is it that makes a good pilot? Is it that long years of experience?
Neil, some of them react with jealousy. We have right now an unusual situation in the airlines because they haven't been hiring a lot lately. They've laid off a lot of people. They're about to extend the retirement age from 60 to 65, so at this moment, we have a pilot crew core with an unusual degree of experience. If the airlines start to expand again, that won't be so. Clearly, experience has value, and probably at some of these things, you do get better as you get older.
There has also been a great deal of technology devoted to airplanes, particularly passenger airliners, and well, the safety record the last several years has been exceptionally good.
We went 30 months without a without a passenger fatality in scheduled aviation, which is unprecedented.
And is that good pilots? Is that good technology or both?
Well, probably some of both. Probably this, I won't call it a landing, but the splashdown in the Hudson is a result of good piloting, but also good technology. I mean, that's an airplane with lots of exits, with rafts. It's designed to float. Probably it all came together the right way.
Well, we're going to get some pilots on the line with us to tell us about how their life has changed professionally and about what makes a good pilot. 800-989-8255 is our phone number. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Don. Don's with us from Cary, North Carolina.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead, Don.
Hi. Well, I think ever since deregulation, the airline industry has gone downhill. I worked my way up from the civilian side as a commuter pilot, as they derogatorily referred to it, and put 34 years in, mostly as a captain. More equipment, more sophisticated equipment and so forth over the years. And all I can say is Sully's work was superb airmanship. But management has treated us often like streetwalkers. I've been told more than once, you can be replaced. There's plenty of applicants out there.
So this is not the glamorous job it once was?
No, the long layovers. I did all regional flying. I think one of the best lines I ever heard was, you remember the old Bob Newhart show? He had a character who was an airline pilot,
mm-hmm.
and he came in, he says, where's Bob? Oh, he's doing a book tour. He's in Cleveland tonight. And the guy came back and said, yeah, Cleveland, they have some of the loveliest roofs I've ever seen. But it's all 25-minute turns now. It's minimal overnights. In other words, the FAA says 8 hours, and that's what you're going to get. And often there's this constant battling with management. It's put a warm body in the cockpit and get going.
And, Don, you're probably flying more hours per month than you used to be, right?
I would say I've flown 80 hours pretty much through my whole career, 75 to 80 hours. The regional flying has always been heavier than, the trunk routes or the international flying.
But, and you're still in the regional airlines. Do you still have a prospect of moving up to a...
Well, there's many things, like you said earlier. They're not hiring. The big thing with airline pilots is, seniority. You get hired, your progression, the equipment you fly, the places you live are all done by seniority. So once you invest, 10, 15 years in an airline, you're kind of committed to it. And it's all up to management, whether you have a job in the future, whether you have a retirement or so forth, because you got to start at the bottom. It's not like, I don't want to say radio personalities, but, let's say somebody in a radio show, I hear there's an opening in L.A. I can go there, and, you can ask for money. You can't do that in an airline. You have to, when you start at the bottom, no matter whether you have thousands of hours or hundreds of hours.
Well, I started at a small station. That happened to be in New York City, but nevertheless.
Yeah, but the thing is, you can progress and you can get more money with different operations. You can't do that in the airline.
Given,
that goes for flight attendants. That goes for mechanics.
Sure, but given the experience you're citing, and I don't think you're unique at all in the points you're making, what about that safety record, which was exceptional?
I don't follow what your safety record or the airline in.
Well, if airline pilots are being asked to fly more hours, shorter turnarounds, how do you explain at the same time that the safety record has been so good?
Well, a lot of the accidents in past decades were equipment and systematic things. They've eliminated a lot of that. The type of airplane, years ago you were flying in the weather at marginal airports. Today, the airports are improved, the aircraft is improved. So they've taken a lot of those systematic failures, and now more and more of it is human factors. Things like crew resource management, there's an awful lot of professionalism out of there. When you work at some jobs, if the boss doesn't treat you well or the job is not rewarding, it's close enough for government kind of work answer, but in the airline industry, the pilots are committed professionally. They get in there and they say, I want to do the best job I've ever done every day.
Well, Don, thanks very much, and we appreciate what you do for us.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye. We're going to hear a lot about the bosses. We did invite the Air Transport Association of America, the trade group of the principal U.S. airlines, to send a representative to be on today's program. A spokeswoman for the organization told us no one from the ATA was available to join us today, so we did want to hear from the bosses as well. We're not going to get that opportunity. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Jennifer. Jennifer from Duluth, Minnesota.
Hi. My husband and I flew Blackhawks in the Army for 8-9 years.
Helicopters, yeah.
Yes, helicopters. So it's a little different, but just a few comments. The most dangerous time for an emergency to happen is takeoff and landing, because you're so busy talking on the radio and preparing yourself. But my comment was, and it spoke earlier to your comment about someday someone's going to say, well, he did have the fuel or the time to do this and this and that, and every accident in the Army is investigated, and there's a flight facts publication that comes out, and the accidents are classified A, which is catastrophic or death, you know, down to E. But we use that as a learning point, and it's not just learning about human error, but a lot of it's learning about how machines actually do work and respond in certain situations. And because of the flight facts publications and the investigations, our Dash 10, which is the operating manual, would actually, you know, change and evolve.
Matt Wall does the NTSB, investigates accidents for commercial planes. Do they do the same kind of a job that Jennifer is describing the military does?
They will pull this accident apart bit by bit. At the moment, they're having a lab do analysis to see whether the geese were resident geese or were migratory geese. They will suck every available detail out of this accident and the one in Rochester, because you've got to learn from accidents, but you also have to learn from daily operations, because the number of accidents is now so small that you've got to have more data sources.
But is the system equivalent to what Jennifer's talking about in the military?
No. The military is a lousy airline. I don't mean to dump on your caller. Blackhawks fly at low altitude and lousy weather. The military crashes a lot of planes. The airlines don't. The military can still use crashes as a good database. The civilian guys have moved on into computer surveillance of everything they do. So you can go through the last 100 landings of, say, a certain type of airplane at a certain airport and see if there were any unusual procedures in any of them and go back and find out what the reason was. You've got to do detailed data analysis of daily operations, not just crashes.
Jennifer, I'd fly with you anytime.
Well, I just want to say the military, obviously the purpose and the mission is very different. So
yes,
agreed.
There are more accidents, but thank you very much. I love your show.
Thanks very much, Jennifer. Bye. We're getting a peek inside the cockpit today at the life and training of pilots. What makes a good one? If you fly commercial jets, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. One big safety issue for long-haul pilots is sleep. Last fall, the FAA doubled the amount of time flight crews must spend at their destination after what are called ultra-long-range flights, from 24 hours to 48. A group of U.S. airlines recently sued to roll back the requirement. Our focus today is on the training and the ever-changing lives of commercial pilots. If you fly commercial jets, give us a call. What makes a good pilot? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Matt Wald is with us. He's aviation safety reporter for the New York Times. And for many years, John Nance flew the Boeing 737 for Alaska Airlines as a captain. In his career, he logged over 13,000 hours in the air. He's now an author and an aviation analyst for ABC News. He joins us now from the studios of KUOW, our member station in Seattle. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be with you. And Matt, I haven't talked to you for a while.
Yes, John.
And I have to ask you, John Nance, how is the profession changing over the years? I guess you go back to the days when it was considered a pretty glamorous profession.
Well, I got into probably the last of the golden age. I think in the 70s, I started with Braniff International, which not all that many people remember anymore. We went bankrupt on May 12th of 1982 at 4:34 in the afternoon. Not that I remember it well.
Uh-huh. Great, and then I joined great livery Alaska. On those planes.
Yes. Oh, it was. It was. And it was a very pace-setting. Matter of fact, you go on airplanes today and see leather seats and colorful exteriors. We did that at Braniff, but that's all forgotten. At any rate, the thing was, at that time, we had both a good and a bad in terms of the golden age. The good was that it was still a very glamorous profession. You had a lot of respect as a captain. You ended up with a tremendous amount of authority. The bad part of it was that standardization was very bad. I remember many captains who simply wouldn't read checklists, something that you would never, ever find today.
They wouldn't read checklists?
Oh, I can tell you, as a flight engineer on a 727, many times I've had captains turn around and say, don't bother me with a checklist, just get the killer items. And if you tried to complain, you were told, I'm sorry, that's a captain and you're a second officer, and we simply aren't going to pursue it. Now, here in the, by the mid-80s, we had learned a tremendous amount. And one of the things that I don't think we've been talking about here in the earlier part of this program was the fact that, and it was mentioned, crew resource management, but the revolution that we have had from about 1985 to the present day is very profound and is the very cause of the safety levels that we have now. And that is the fact that we fired Captain Kirk. We fired that individual. We took the left seat basically and said, you will conform to minimization of variables and to using checklists. And by the way, Captain, if you want to fly for this airline, you are going to create an atmosphere in which your first officer can and will always speak up to you, because one carbon-based brain isn't enough.
So Spock is flying a lot more planes than Kirk these days.
Yeah, in effect, we basically, I guess in Star Trek terms, I know there's a generation out there that doesn't even know what I'm talking about. But
they will next summer, but yeah.
In Star Trek terms, basically, we hired Jean-Luc Picard.
Well, you did something else. John, you did something else, which is you laid off, as you were saying, you were a flight engineer. We're now down to two guys in the cockpit instead of one. And some of them aren't guys anymore. I suppose that makes a difference, too. That might be an advantage in some circumstances.
Oh, I've always been a tremendous proponent of women in the cockpit. They actually can take more G's than we can in fighter operations in Air Force and Navy. But, in fact, they are excellent, excellent pilots in every way, and they always were. But they were discriminated against terribly, as you can imagine. It was a good old boys environment.
Now let's get some more pilots on the line who are calling us. Let's go to Jan. Jan with us from Chicago.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. Yes, I am a commercial airline pilot. I was a Navy pilot, one of the early women pilots in the Navy. And just as an aside, because of a lot of these issues, I'm currently running for Congress here in Chicago. So taking a break from the voters, and I want to address this issue because it's extremely important.
Go ahead.
One thing that I think that pilots are trained to do is to constantly assess and reassess a situation, sort of a how's it working. And this particular flight is a perfect example. We follow our procedures, but we're constantly reassessing. Originally, they took off, as I understand it, and when they had the bird strike, they attempted to turn around and go back. Then they realized that wasn't going to work, so they tried to look to another airport, and then they realized that wasn't going to work. And at that point, the decision was made, we're going to make the best choice we can, and we're going to do it the best we can. And I think that speaks wonders to our training and to the personality type.
And the point that you bring out about that, is it the personality type? Is it the training?
I think it's a bit of both. I know when we were selected for the military, we went through extensive testing, and we did the same in commercial airlines. Whether you came from civilian or you came through military background, there's personality tests, there's background checks, for example. There's a whole range of testing to try and get to that personality test, and then we're now also have the extensive training to capitalize on that.
Well, I think, and wouldn't you agree with me, this is John Nance, wouldn't you agree with me that also our very rigid standardization in the military does a tremendous amount to put us into that mold where, we become the same type of individual, very focused on minimization of variables, as I said, and on checklist utilization and not having to relearn the lessons we've learned in the past.
Absolutely. And that training for attention to detail, my kids will assess. Both my husband and I are commercial airline pilots, and sometimes they would like us to maybe have a little less attention to detail.
Understood. By the way, I'm an Air Force pilot, and I got to tell you guys, the difference between Air Force and Navy is really easy for pilots. Air Force pilots like their airfields to remain exactly where we leave them. Navy folks, they don't mind if they go floating off.
Well, Jan, and by the way, this is Jan Donatelli, is that right?
Yes, it is.
And you're up. There's a primary election today.
Today, as a matter of fact. So we are luckily we have a warm day for Chicago, and we're out talking to voters and trying to get that every last minute vote.
Well, I hope your landings as a candidate are softer than your landings as a naval aviator.
Oh, I have great landings. Thank you,
Jan. Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to this is Tim. Tim calling from Chicago as well.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm well. I hope you're not running for Congress, too.
No, I'm not. No, but I am an airline pilot. I fly for a regional carrier out of O'Hare here. And I think I appreciate all the previous callers talk about the professionalism of pilots. Speaking for maybe the younger generation of pilots, I see it. We fly, in my airline, we have quite a bit of experience among our captains, because it did take a long time to to upgrade from first officer to captain in my regional airline. But that's not the case with all regional airlines. Talking about the importance of experience, a lot of regional airlines have very quick upgrade times, or at least they did, where there's captains who, they're captains on smaller jets, but there's still 50 to 70-seat jets, as many as 90-seat jets in regional airlines. And they don't have as much experience. They have, maybe only as little as 3,000 to 5,000 hours of flying time, whereas you look at Captain Sullenberger, who had, I think, over 25,000 or something.
Yeah.
But that's just as the airlines move to more and more regional flying over the last 10, 15 years, I think that's just the nature of the beast. I don't think there's any way to avoid that. There wasn't enough experienced pilots. Pilots have to gain their experience somewhere. So the result is that you have less experienced pilots in the cockpit. But I feel like the training has gotten so much better over the last 20 years that with crew resource management and with the help of, more experienced captains that we hold our own.
Tim, if I can hop in, this is Matt Wald. You do get something from experience, but you can't say that Sullenberger did a good job because he'd ever landed in the Hudson before.
And correct.
Airplanes are now so reliable that somebody can go through an entire career and never experience an engine failure.
Right.
So it's correct that experience will help you with certain situations, but the really bad situations, the ones we're talking about today, are once-in-a-lifetime or once-in-many-lifetime experiences.
I agree completely, and I feel like the way experience works, and I feel it myself, I've only been flying, the biggest plane I flew 3 years ago had four seats in it, including my own. And now I'm a first officer, and I fly 50 people around constantly out of O'Hare, and I feel myself, I could the feeling I get when I feel like I'm gaining experience is sort of one where it's, I haven't had to declare an emergency yet with my airline, but I feel like just thinking as I'm flying, my thinking changes. The more and more I experience things, I think about things. Maybe we'll have a caution light go off, and I'll think about the possibilities more. The more I fly, the more I experience these things, the more I think about them, and also the more the routine stuff becomes second nature enough where I can sort of expand my thinking in the day-to-day flying. And I agree. I mean, I hope I never have to land in the Hudson or any other river, but I feel like there's a equal role for experience as there is for maybe personality type or just good training,
I can tell you, Tim, that it even goes down to passengers. Suddenly people look up at that phrase, in the unlikely event of a water landing.
Exactly. And, the other day we had a maintenance problem before takeoff, and we had to return to the gate. And we apologized to the passengers. Normally that would cause a lot of anger. And I felt like I didn't see anyone angry. Everyone was thanking us. And I that was a new experience for us.
Okay, Tim. Good luck to you.
Communication.
Thank you very
communication
much.
Communication from...
Here's a point about training, Rick, via email. Before the Federal Reserve changed the rules for processing checks, there were thousands of airline pilot wannabes honing their skills flying checks overnight in all kinds of weather. What has replaced this skill-building employment for those training for airline careers in the civilian world? John Nance?
Well, the answer to that is there's still an awful lot of overnight cargo, even though the checks have been minimized in terms of the flying. There's still an awful lot of cargo dogs, as they call themselves, good folks with very small and sometimes not so small carriers flying small airplanes, and that provides an entry level for a lot of people before they get on with the commuter-regional. But let me make a point here that what Tim was talking about and what all of us have been talking about. Experience is excellent, but an experienced pilot can make a mistake too. Basically, we have learned, and the military is certainly Air Force, Navy, Marines, we're the pioneers on this, and being able to say we can train experience into a very young pilot. This is why we can put people out there at 400 or 500 hours to land on carriers and do a very, very good job. We can do this in the airlines, too. We have people with 1,200 hours sitting in the right seat of a regional jet. If the training is sufficient, and this is the big question, if the airline is paying enough attention not just to the FAA minimums, but doing the training where it needs to be to train that experience in before they've got the number of hours, then you've got a crew that's going to do as good a job probably as Sullenberger. And I don't want to take anything away from Sully Sullenberger. He did an excellent job. But as I've been telling my folks at ABC, there was no miracle. If you fly the airplane the way we know how to fly it, if you follow the book, you've got a procedure to follow to get it into the Hudson. You've got a procedure to follow to try to get over to Teterboro. He wouldn't have made it to Teterboro, by the way, but there was a procedure. The brilliance of what aviation safety has done is that it has, by putting procedures into place, unloaded the cognitive capability of the captain and the first officer to be able to have a bubble of time, in this case 10 or 15 seconds, to make a critical decision. Do we go for that runway and take a chance, or do we go for the river? If we had not unloaded them, if he had to reinvent the wheel each time and say, oh my God, if I'm going to go to the river, do I put the gear down? Do I keep it up? Do I put the flaps out? Do I keep them up? He probably wouldn't have been able to make that decision.
John Nance, an aviation analyst for ABC News, a former airlines pilot. Also with us, Matt Wall, the aviation safety reporter for The New York Times. What makes a good pilot? You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Larry on the line. Larry with us from Salem, Oregon.
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I'm a corporate pilot, and I've got more of the 135, they call it Part 135, as opposed to the airline industry, which is Part 121. It's charter and on-demand stuff. Having flown a lot of marginal equipment and a whole different side of it, I, first of all, will never place pilots in any kind of God status. Flying with hundreds of different pilots, you see the full gamut from just blithering idiots to incredible geniuses, just like in any occupation, I think. But
Hardly ever in radio.
No. One thing that I think that I personally dislike, but it's becoming more of a systems management operation where everything's becoming more computerized, more glass cockpits. And there was actually a pilot I met that instead of Joe Blow pilot, it was Joe Blow systems manager. And I think there's a lot of heads down programming of computers and letting the computer fly the airplane as opposed to good stick and rudder skills.
Is there too much automation, Matt Wald?
Well, you think about recent crashes. The one that comes to mind is an American Airlines 757 that hit a mountain outside Cali, Colombia, because they programmed a computer wrong. After that, the airlines went out and put in yet another system, and this system uses GPS and a database to warn you when you're heading towards a mountain. And we haven't had that kind of flight into terrain since then. You can trace a lot of these computerized systems back to an individual crash or a repeated problem. And we have eliminated or come close to eliminating some of those categories. But it does mean that, yeah, you are a computer manager as opposed to dealing with mechanical stuff.
This is the heart of crew resource management, and we did have that absolutely in the Cali-Columbia accident. Two heads down, both of them trying to figure out what was going on. As a matter of fact, one of the most dangerous phrases we have in today's modern cockpits is, quote, "Why do you suppose it's doing that?" end quote. And we also have the schism between Airbus and Boeing. Airbus wanting to go with more and more automation. Boeing saying the pilot should always be in control of the airplane. We even have a problem that is going to be very interesting to see how the safety board comes out with their report on whether the engines in this Airbus A320, had they not been computer controlled, could have been kept in operation even imperfectly.
That was Sullenberger's plan, yeah.
That's right. It's a very dirty question. Airbus is scared of it, but we've got to find it out because maybe with more mechanical controls and less computerization, those engines could have been kept producing some thrust. I do not know the answer.
And we're going to find out in this crash in Buffalo of last month whether a more heavily computerized airplane that forbid you to pitch up so high might have saved the airplane. And pilots hate the idea that they're flying an airplane that won't let them do what they want to do. But in some designs, there are mistakes the machine will not allow the human to make.
Hmm. Well, Matt, I agree with that, except let me make this point.
And we've had a loss of an
Airbus A320 and a group that the pilots put it into a stall condition at too low an altitude. It was a test flight, and the computer just completely lost control of it.
Yes.
There is a very valid question on whether or not we have over-computerized or whether or not the pilots have been too disconnected from the system by this computerization.
Yes.
I'm not anti-Airbus. I'm saying it's a decent question.
Yes.
We're going to have to leave it there. Larry, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we just heard from John Nance, a former Boeing 737 pilot for Alaska Airlines, as Annie mentioned. Braniff as well, with us today from KULW, our member station in Seattle. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Neil.
He was also an analyst for ABC News. Matt Wald, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Neil.
Matt Wald is the aviation safety reporter for the New York Times with us from our bureau in New York. And whether you're a pilot or not, stay tuned. Later today, Melissa Bach talks with the air traffic controller who coached a student pilot to a safe landing after the student failed three times to bring the plane down. That's later today on All Things Considered. Up next on this program, does anyone really know how to invest in this stock market? Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.